This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 2, 2002. From Chiapas, Mexico, I'm Deepa Fernandez. In a landmark decision, a New York federal judge rules that the death penalty is unconstitutional in New York City. The U.S. bombs a wedding celebration in Afghanistan, killing over 120 people and wounding many more. And in Boston, a Palestinian student activist is tortured by the INS. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Palestinians say the Israeli occupation has gone back to pre-Oslo Accord days as the Israeli army extends its reach beyond main cities, take over smaller villages, and arrest scores of young men. Awadu Davis has more from the West Bank.
The arrest campaign is ongoing. Today only some 70 Palestinians were arrested in several villages who are also under curfew. In the city of Hebron, Israeli army attacked a local college during the lifting of the curfew and arrested dozens of students. This was also the case in the American University near Jenin City in the north of the West Bank. Meanwhile, the cities of Ramallah, Nablus, Tulkarim, Bethlehem, and Qalqilia are still under curfew, where residents are not even allowed to get out of their own houses, not even for food supply. And while the Israeli Defense Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer is talking about dismantling some settlements, the Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres is saying again that Arafat is not a partner in peace anymore. In the Palestinian side, the West Bank is all under Israeli military occupation, and the only sign of the Palestinian Authority left is the person of Yasser Arafat in what left from his compound in Ramallah. This is Awad Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News from the Palestinian-occupied territories.
The Supreme Court in Chile ruled last night that former dictator General Augusto Pinochet was mentally unfit to stand trial for his part in the so-called caravan of death. In their 4-1 ruling, the court said Pinochet is exempt from standing trial for his alleged participation in the execution of political opponents carried out by military squads under his control shortly after he overthrew the world's only democratically elected Marxist, Salvador Allende, in 1973. A court spokesperson said Pinochet suffers from dementia and would therefore be unable to mount his own defense. The lawyer filing the case said it was for mental incompetence, not lack of evidence, that the case was thrown out. The president of the group, Families of the Detained and Disappeared, said while the ruling was no surprise, it means Pinochet will continue to evade responsibility for his violations of human rights. Black farmers are still holed up at a U.S. Department of Agriculture building in Tennessee, refusing to leave until the agency processes loan applications. Hal Humphreys reports from Nashville.
More than 150 farmers amassed at the Farm Service Agency in Brownsville, Tennessee yesterday. The farmers, all African-American, oppose USDA lending practices that they say are part of a conspiracy to get rid of black farmers. Since 1920, black farmers have dwindled in number from nearly 1 million to less than 20,000 nationwide. In 1999, the USDA settled a multi-million dollar lawsuit with African-American farmers who said they were denied loans by regional bureaus. Kerry Johnson with the Farm Service Office in Jackson admits there have been past civil rights issues, but doesn't know of any intentional loan denials recently. 15 of the protesters, some of whom staged a 21-day sit-in in Covington, Tennessee in 1981, said they're prepared to stay indefinitely. Activists plan to hold more protests in southern states in the next few months. Hal Humphreys, Free Speech Radio News, Nashville.
President Bush offered up more compassionate conservatism today and encourage congressional leaders to take people off welfare and move them to an already stagnant job market. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
President Bush was in Milwaukee today pushing welfare legislation that demands 40-hour work weeks from beneficiaries. Deepak Bhargava, director of the National Campaign for Jobs and Income Support, explains that the 40-hour work week is excessive.
40 hours divided by the benefits that people typically receive, it works out to a lot less than the minimum wage. So what the president is really proposing with his 40-hour week idea is workfare jobs at $1 or $2 an hour.
Both Republican and Democratic proposals include $200 million to promote marriage among welfare recipients. Advocates for the poor repeatedly stress that the 1996 welfare reform bill, due to be reauthorized in a similar version this year, does not alleviate poverty, demands excessive work hours from working mothers, and represents a major conservative victory against supporting the working poor. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
According to the London Independent and other news sources, U.S. forces dropped a B-52 bomb on an Afghan wedding party earlier yesterday. Reports vary, but it appears that the U.S. attack came in response to celebratory rifle shots fired by guests at the party. Between 120 and 250 civilians are said to have been killed, possibly the largest number of non-combatants killed at U.S. hands since the war began. Speaking today at a press conference, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld insisted that data on the attack and resulting casualties is not reliable. He says that the UN and Afghan investigators are just beginning to gather evidence.
What we do not know is the information that will be gained by talking to non-U.S. forces who were on the ground.
Both a B-52 bomber and an AC-130 gunship were active above the area in southern Afghanistan when the wedding party took place. The Pentagon acknowledged that one of seven precision-guided missiles did not hit its target and that the aircrafts were responding to fire from the ground. But officials would not confirm any allegations of civilian casualties. U.S. military officials on the ground in Afghanistan have expressed sympathy with any civilians injured or killed by U.S. fire. But as Free Speech Radio News correspondent Fariba Nawar reports, such sentiments may simply not be enough for the Afghan people.
Afghans are normally thanking Americans for getting rid of the Taliban, but after numerous U.S.-led military operations that have killed innocent civilians, their gratefulness is wearing thin. The latest attack Monday in Uruzgan, where 160 people are believed dead, has sparked anger and resentment against American troops. The U.S. has apologized for mistaking wedding shots in the air for an attack on its coalition forces. But the apology isn't enough. For nearly 5 hours of bombing, some six villages, Afghans say. The details of the attack are still hazy. Afghan President Hamid Karzai and the Coalition Against Terrorism has asked the United Nations to help investigate the disaster. A UN convoy tomorrow will drive 9 hours from Kandahar to the area where Karzai rallied against the Taliban last fall. A UN official said he was anxious to find out the details of what happened, but said it might be too difficult to find out the truth since there were conflicting reports on both sides. Home to the notorious Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Omar, Uruzgan has been under scrutiny since fall. Some Afghans say the wedding party should have known that firing gunshots, a time-honored tradition in this country, would trigger trouble. But most say the coalition forces, with all their technology and know-how, should know better and stop taking Afghan hospitality for granted. One Afghan woman said, "We will turn against the best of our friends if they continue to lie to us and betray us. And America is going in that direction." For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Nawar in Herat.
In a landmark decision, a federal judge in New York yesterday declared the death penalty unconstitutional, saying evidence has shown that there is, quote, an undue risk that a meaningful number of innocent people have been executed. The ruling by Judge Jed S. Rakoff is the first to declare the current federal death penalty unconstitutional. And while it applies only in a pending case before Judge Rakoff in the Manhattan District, the ruling is certain to rekindle the debate over capital punishment. From New York, Aaron Glantz has more.
In his ruling, Judge Rakoff noted more than 100 death row inmates have been exonerated since the death penalty was reinstated by the Supreme Court in 1973. Since 1993, 12 death row inmates have been exonerated on the basis of DNA evidence. David Kaczynski of New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty.
Essentially, what he's saying is that it is a violation of due process to execute someone because sentence, it cuts off the time in which they have to present evidence of their innocence. And when we have the system working as poorly as our capital justice system has worked across this this country, evidently prisoners, death row inmates need every opportunity that they can get.
Do you think that you would continue to be fighting this case if your son was not dead? Do you feel like due process was violated in this case?
Certainly. I sure do.
So you would still be fighting this case, you and your son?
Yes.
Jim Fowler's son, Mark Fowler, was executed last year by the state of Oklahoma. Key prosecution evidence came from Oklahoma City Police scientist Joyce Gilchrist, who has since been found to have fabricated forensic evidence in more than 130 cases.
My son denied ever being in the room where the man was killed and denied to his last day that he took part in the killing.
On July 23rd, the state of Oklahoma is set to execute Randall Cannon. Joyce Gilchrist's testimony is key to the state's case in that trial as well. Although state authorities admit Gilchrist fabricated the forensic evidence that proved the guilt of Cannon's alleged accomplice. In nearby Missouri, Amnesty International's Sue Gunwada Vaughn says state authorities are getting ready to execute a possibly innocent man, Joseph Amreen.
The state's case against him at his trial, which was in 1986, consisted of the testimony of three inmates, all of whom have since recanted, saying that they lied under threats or offers from the authorities. Even after these facts were revealed, the court system failed to grant Mr. Amreen a new trial.
Death penalty opponents are nonetheless optimistic after Judge Rakoff's ruling and two recent Supreme Court rulings restricting the death penalty. They say that concern may be building towards a national moratorium on executions.
It might ultimately be symbolic, but it's an important symbol that a federal judge comes to this conclusion that it's not an abolitionist, you know, one of the usual abolitionist suspects who are saying this, I think is really useful.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in New York.
Despite widespread public and legal pressure, the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service continues to imprison hundreds, if not thousands, of immigrants on technical visa violations or similar minor charges. In recent months, Department of Justice has stepped up the repression in a wave of detentions apparently directed at secular, politically active immigrants. After a hearing last Thursday, Boston area resident Jawdat Albasa remains in prison, where he's been subjected to what some are calling torture. Wahid Jenkins files this report.
They believe they are trying to send a message to all those who will stand up for Palestinian rights, to all those who will stand up in opposition to the government's really dirty war against the movement in this country.
That was the voice of Boston area anti-war activist Steve Kirschbaum. On May 30th, prominent Palestinian rights activist and Canadian citizen Jawdat Albasa was arrested in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and charged with five minor vehicular violations. Cambridge police suspected he was a terrorist and notified the FBI. Within days, he was interrogated, denied bond in Cambridge District Court, and then moved to the Bristol County House of Corrections. For much of the last 5 weeks, he has been imprisoned in solitary confinement and continually interrogated by federal agents. Albasa's lawyer, Emily Karstetter, explains.
He was questioned not just once, but repeatedly. And I believe probably in ways that were designed to suggest to him that things were going to be easier for him if he was helpful to them.
Albasa is charged with entry without proper inspection. He faces additional criminal charges in Cambridge District Court. Again, Emily Karstetter.
If he's done anything, he's done what doesn't amount to much, number one. Number two, he is presumed innocent. And number three, he's now been in jail for more time than someone without a criminal record would ever do on this kind of an offense.
On Thursday, June 27th, Mr. Albasa appeared for a second time in Boston Immigration Court to determine his custody status and possible release on bond. Some 100 supporters staged a picket line outside and crowded into Judge Shapiro's courtroom. Ominously, the government prosecutors moved to close the hearing to the public, but Judge Shapiro denied the request. Over the objections of the prosecution, Judge Shapiro ruled that Albasa must be released on voluntary departure within the next month, giving the INS until July 29th to file an appeal. Most ominous are the allegations of the forced removal of Mr. Abuaza's teeth. According to Mr. Albasa, on the morning of Sunday, June 16th, he was taken to an infirmary, seated in a chair, and told he was to have 8 teeth pulled. Speaking in broken English without a translator present, he told the doctor he didn't want his teeth removed and stood to leave. According to multiple accounts, he was forced into the chair by 2 guards, restrained with metal straps, his mouth forced open, and sedated with an unidentified spray in the mouth. When he came to, the doctor was removing 4 molars. In the process, one broke, leaving a jagged, bleeding tooth behind. He was given no painkiller or antibiotics and then returned to his cell. Chaudat's physician, Dr. Lana Habish of the Boston Medical Center, has grave concerns about the procedure and the conflicting documentation presented to her by prison officials.
There's no documentation of the consent form that's been signed. There's no documentation in the chart. The dental x-rays were ever done. It says here, referral to dentist, no. If I had not reviewed the dental records myself, spoken with the dentist, and heard the patient's accounts of events, I would find a hard time believing it. But the evidence is there that there's serious discrepancies in the record.
Bristol Jail Supervisor Sheriff Thomas Hodgson maintains that the procedure was routine and even requested by Abuaza. According to the brief official medical report, Abuaza complained of pain and went to the infirmary with a bleeding tooth. The physician who completed the procedure states that he extracted 1 tooth only and 3 root tips. Abuaza's physician, Dr. Habish, has placed calls all the way to the White House in attempts to gain access to her patient and complete the x-ray exams necessary to determine the validity of the allegations of torture.
If everything is as INS states that it is, I would think that they would want him to have a formal evaluation so that they could prove that what they're saying is true. It makes me highly suspicious that they've made it this difficult.
Chaudat Abuaza's detention came just days before a scheduled rally for Palestinian rights, a point often raised during his interrogations. His detention had a chilling effect on the Boston area community of Arab political activists. Friend Amer Jubran comments.
There are the progressives, the locals, the non-Arabs who are rallying to support Chaudat. They are expressing outrage, but the Arabic community and the Palestinian community is electing to hide at this point.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Wajid Jenkins.
Israeli defense forces overran most of the West Bank Monday, including all major towns and cities except Jericho. In Hebron, the Israeli military lifted curfew for a few hours for students at the Palestinian Polytechnical Institute to take final exams. Then they rounded up 300 students, blindfolding many and arresting 7. As part of the action, the Israeli forces also continued to make widespread arrests as part of what's now called, quote, Operation Determined Path. In total, some 1,000 Palestinians are currently held by the IDF. This is the largest number of detainees since the first days of the Intifada. As nearly 1 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza live under house arrest due to the Israeli military-imposed curfew, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Katha Mester talked to Palestinian Authority spokeswoman Dr. Hannah Ashrawi in Ramallah.
For 4 hours, the paralyzed city transformed into a bustling metropolis as Palestinians jammed the streets to buy food, water, and to socialize, while Israeli soldiers retreated into commandeered apartments, parking tanks and armored personnel carriers on the front lawns of Palestinian residences. Issam Rukab owns a popular ice creamery in Ramallah. He says the Israeli occupation is choking Palestinian businesses.
I'll be lucky if I get like 10% of last year's business. It's very bad.
Rukab says businesses with perishable goods are especially threatened, even though customers continue to buy out the limited supply of partially wilted produce.
The customers, as usual, they got used to this being occupied.
However, other Palestinians strongly disagree. Adam, who is 25 years old, is from Hebron. He has been stuck in Ramallah away from his family for 6 months.
I see that I'm outside, but I don't feel that I'm outside. Because for a few hours I can't do anything. I want to buy something to eat. I'm not a human anymore, you know. Just to get out, to have some food and cigarettes, you know, and nothing.
His frustration is shared by many other Palestinians. 30 spent the afternoon marching through the gridlock traffic of Al Manara Square, protesting the occupation. They say, Bush, you are not a good man. You speak of democracy, but you do not know what democracy means.
Bush, nothing. And Sharon, nothing. Very bad, Sharon and Bush, because the life no good. The soldiers are in Ramallah, in Nablus, in Hebron. What doing Bush? Bush, nothing.
As the people of Ramallah finished their shopping, many spent the remainder of the afternoon on domestic activities. Rahman Mansouri used the last hour before curfew to work with her son in the garden.
I felt for the next week, I think we can't go out to do anything, so I took advantage from the situation to water my plants. At least, I use it as therapy.
Mansouri says her family is restless. Her son wants to play outside with his friends, she wants to visit her parents, and her husband wants to return to work. She says the only thing she has been able to do during curfew is watch television and think.
I don't think Mr. Bush, he can take it, or his wife. She can take it, or Clinton, or any American. And I invite him, invite his ambassador also, to come here and live really what the Palestinians are living. It's a hell.
The hell she described is not only the boredom and frustration of living under house arrest, but the sounds of gunfire, shelling, and patrolling tanks, keeping many in Ramallah awake throughout the night.
You climb over that barrier, you go to town. Okay. You have to go from the garden.
Okay.
To our neighbors, my sister's house.
Okay.
But you have to run because we don't want them to see you.
Dr. Hanan Ashrawi offered an alternative exit to her house after this reporter was pursued by an Israeli armored personnel carrier, attempting to prevent Dr. Ashrawi from conducting an interview. She's on the Palestinian Authority's Legislative Council and lives in a closed military zone across the street from Yasser Arafat's compound. All of her neighbors' houses have been reduced to rubble. Dr. Ashrawi recently endorsed a letter signed by some 200 Palestinian intellectuals condemning suicide bombings.
Any type of leadership requires, first of all, the objective conditions, and two, the climate, the proper climate. So while Israel is escalating, while it is legitimizing violence against civilians, we have the uphill struggle of trying to delegitimize violence against civilians, even though we're on the receiving end of an organized, political, state-sponsored, army-implemented violence against civilians. So it's very difficult to introduce, to inject a new type of logic and to persuade the Palestinians not to do unto others what was done unto them.
Dr. Ashrawi says she and other Palestinian officials appealed to the different political leaders and factions within the community to derail future suicide bombings, but worries that very little can be done to redirect public sentiment away from a sense of victimization while the Israeli military occupies the West Bank and Gaza. After 4 hours, everyone is inside. The Israeli army reimposed curfew. For Free Speech Radio News in Ramallah, I'm Kata Mester.
The devastating wildfire that roared through eastern Arizona left its mark in a most unpredictable fashion, with unblemished homes standing amid charcoal pits of destruction. And as we highlight issues of globalization in U.S.-Mexico relations this month, we look at the area in Arizona where many Mexican immigrants have settled, amid what are called wildcat subdivisions by some and colonias by others. These irregular settlements are spreading throughout the state of Arizona, and, with few other options, the overwhelming majority of residents are Mexican immigrants. A symptom of the national housing crisis, such infrastructure-poor communities attract people searching for affordable shelter and rural living. But, as Kent Patterson reports, as the fires have proved, the wildcat subdivisions are creating new social, economic, and environmental problems. He files this report from Pima County, Arizona.
Actually, some situations that I've seen, there might be family members who live on a lot and then they have a more permanent trailer or double wide and then they have a sister.
Driving her pickup down a dusty, gutted road, Tucson neighborhood activist Kelly Waters describes the jumble of trailers and homes that make up this community known as Old Nogales Highway. Situated about 10 miles south of Tucson, the community is considered a wildcat subdivision or colonia. Within the past few years, upwards of 4,000 people, including many Mexican immigrants, have found inexpensive land here. Like many other southwestern colonias, Old Nogales Highway lacks paved roads, postal service, and a sewage system. Waters stops her truck to chat with Bertha, a local resident, who explains some of the hazards confronting residents when they need fire and other emergency services.
He can come here because no water or turn it out of fire. And most of the houses here is mobile homes. Mm-hmm. 5 minutes is fire.
Do you have a lot of fires here?
But over there, behind to the school over there, is 3 houses. Yeah. and the firemen come late. All destroyed.
There's more of a looking like becoming a permanent trailer there with a greenhouse in the back.
A report by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development states that by 1990, about 160,000 people resided in Arizona colonias. That was about 5% of the state's population. By many accounts, the colonial population has exploded in the subsequent years. In addition to Mexican immigrants, the colonial population includes Native Americans, Chicanos, Anglos, and African Americans. These communities provide affordable living for low-income workers, retirees, and others who usually place mobile or manufactured homes on their land. But every form of refuge has its price.
It's more than 4,000 people living in this, what's called a colonia, and the school is at capacity after 3 years with 400 students.
Lucia Sayer is a project coordinator for the nonprofit group Tucson Urban Gardens. Sayer is working on a community food production project in Old Nogales Highway.
One of the main reasons we even started working down there was because people had expressed issues of isolation and lack of access to affordable but also culturally appropriate and good food. There is no supermarket out there. There is no public transportation. The public transportation goes to the casino, conveniently enough, and stops there and turns around. So there's no public access.
I think the county does see it as a problem, and the local nickname is Wildcat Subdivision, and there's a negative association to that.
Laura Huntoon is a professor in the planning department at the University of Arizona. Huntoon and others who have studied the spread of wildcat subdivisions point to lax state oversight of properties that are parceled into small lots without the full complement of infrastructure. Far from the city, colonias put new strains on tight local government budgets. One study, for instance, found that it could cost Pima County between $35 and $45 million to upgrade its colonias. Professor Huntoon.
And I also think that they focused on the financial impact of unregulated subdivision, that there have been more calls for service to the sheriff's office, that the rate of tax generation from these new neighborhoods does not keep pace with the types of services that are needed in these neighborhoods. So that regulated divisions of the county are, in fact, subsidizing through their property taxes these newer areas.
Meanwhile, in Old Nogales Highway, a group of residents plays a volleyball game. Taking a break, Rosa Pesqueda echoes the comments of her neighbors about liking the tranquility and rural atmosphere of the colonia. But Pesqueda says some changes would be welcome.
I would say to look into paving the roads so that we can have better roads, so that police and emergency vehicles like the ambulance or, you know, people who need emergency access can get faster help when they need it, so that our children don't have to be out on the streets or watching TV all day, so that we can have a park, so that we can come and, you know, enjoy the evening like we're doing right now, because we're playing volleyball here at our school because there's nothing more to do.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kent Patterson reporting from Pima County, Arizona.